Chapter 18. Breakfast in the dark. Cooking fires around the square. Voices, quiet men standing with their wives, holding the small children in farewell. The horses saddled. Rifles in the scabbards and blanket rows behind. Four wagons drawn up in the centre of the square with the mules and the traces.
"Paul should be here any minute. It's nearly 5 o'clock," said Gary.
"They're all waiting for him," agreed Sean. He shrugged at the weight of the bandolier strapped over his shoulder.
"Mr. Newhausen has made me one of the wagon drivers."
"I know," said Sean. "Can you handle it?"
"I think so."
Jane Peterson came towards them. "Hello, Jane. Is your brother ready yet?"
"Nearly. Just saddling up."
She stopped in front of Sean and shyly held out a scrap of green and yellow silk.
"I've made a cockade for your hat, Sean."
"Thanks, Jane. Won't you put it on for me?" She pinned up the brim of Sean's hat. He took it back from her and set it at a jaunty angle on his head. "I look like a general now," he said, and she laughed at him. "How about a goodbye kiss, Jane?"
"You're terrible," said little Jane, and went away quickly, blushing.
"Not so little," Sean noticed.
"There were so many of them, you hardly knew where to start." "Here's Pa," announced Gary, as Wait Courtney rode into the square.
"Come on," said Sean, and untied his horse. From all around the square, men were leading out their horses.
"See you later," said Gary,
and limped off towards one of the waiting mule wagons. Wait rode at the head of the column. Four troops of 15 men in double file, four wagons behind them, and then the loose horses driven by black servants. They moved out across the square, through the litter of the night's festivities, and into the main street. The women watched them in silence, standing motionless with the children gathered around them. These women had seen men ride out before against the tribes. They did not cheer, for they too were wise in the ways of death. They had learnt there is no room for glory in the grave. Anna waved to Sean. He didn't see her, for his horse was skittish, and he was past her before he had it under control. She let her hand drop back to her side and watched him go. He wore the sheepskin coat. Sean did see the coppery flash and the swiftly blown kiss from the upstairs window of Pye's store. He saw it because he was looking for it. He forgot his injured pride sufficiently to grin and wave his hat. Then they were out of the town, and at last even the small boys and dogs that ran beside them fell back, and the column trotted out along the road to Zululand. The sun came up and dried the dew. The dust rose from under the hooves and drifted out at an angle from the road. The column lost its rigidity as men spurred ahead or dropped back to ride with their friends. They rode in groups and straggles, relaxed and cheerfully chatting, as informal as a party out for a day's shooting. Each man had taken to the field in the clothing he considered most suitable. Steph Erasmus wore his church suit, but he was the most formally attired of the group. They had only one standard item of uniform among them. This was the green and yellow cockade. However, even here there was scope for individual taste. Some wore them on their hats, some on their sleeves, and others on their chests. They were farmers, not fighting men, but their rifle scabbards were battered with use, their bandoliers worn with easy familiarity, and the wood of their gun-butts was polished from the caress of their hands. It was middle afternoon before they reached the Tugela.
"My God, look at that," whistled Sean. "I've never seen so many people in one place in my life before."
"They say there are 4,000," said Carl.
"I know there are 4,000." Sean ran his eyes over the camp. But I didn't know 4,000 was that many. The column was riding down the last slope to Rourke's Drift. The river was muddy brown and wide, rippling over the shallows of the crossing place. The banks were open and grassy, with a cluster of stone-walled buildings on the near side. In a quarter-mile radius around the buildings, Lord Chelmsford's army was encamped. The tents were picked out in meticulous lines, row upon row, with the horses picketed between them. The wagons were marshalled by the drift, 500 at least, and the whole area swarmed with men. The Ladyburg mounted rifles in a solid bunch that overflowed the road behind their colonel came down to the perimeter of the camp and found their passage blocked by a sergeant in a dress coat and with a fixed bayonet.
"And who may you be, may I ask?"
"Colonel Courtney, and a detachment of the Ladyburg mounted rifles."
"What's that? Didn't catch it."
Wade Courtney stood in his stirrups and turned to face his men.
"Hold it there, gentlemen. We can't all talk at once."
The hubbub of conversation and comment behind him faded, and this time the sergeant heard him.
"Oh, beg your pardon, sir. I'll call the orderly officer."
The orderly officer was an aristocrat and a gentleman. He came and looked at them.
"Colonel Courtney?"
There was a note of disbelief in his voice.
"Hello," said Waite, with a friendly smile. "I hope we are not too late for the fun."
"No, I don't believe you are."
The officer's eyes fastened on Steph Erasmus. Steph lifted his top hat politely.
"Moor, Mynheer."
The bandoliers of ammunition looked a little out of place slung across his black frock coat. The officer tore his eyes away from him.
"You have your own tents, Colonel."
"Yes, we've got everything we need.
I'll get the sergeant here to show you where to make camp."
"Thank you,"
said Waite. The officer turned to the sergeant. So carried away was he that he took the man by the arm. "Put them far away. Put them on the other side of the engineers," he whispered frantically. "If the general sees this lot..." He shuddered, but in a genteel fashion.